We really need to step up our game and give the Coast Guard what they need to protect us, and also give the Department of Defense what they need to allow us to protect our interests.
An effort to fund icebreakers for the Arctic. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, November 29th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Keegan Randall takes a silver medal in Finland.
It's cool to put it out there and have everybody here and have a strong performance and just see, you know, that extra boost of confidence that everything is on track.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. Many Alaska business owners are paying too much for energy. The Commercial Building Energy Audit Program identifies an average of 30% in energy savings. The application period runs November 1st through December 20th. To learn more, visit akenergyefficiency.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Energy Authority.
Senators Lisa Murkowski and Mark Begich are co-sponsoring an amendment to move forward building four heavy icebreakers. The amendment is attached to the Defense Reauthorization Bill in the Senate. It would allow the Navy to begin shopping contracts for bids on all the components necessary to build the costly boats. KNOM's Zachariah Hughes reports.
Matthew Felling is communications director for Senator Murkowski. He says the proposed amendment is designed to tie Arctic awareness to issues of national defense.
Senator Murkowski and Senator Begich and the Washington senators wanted to try and really firmly place icebreakers and the priority of the Arctic agenda into the National Defense Authorization Act through this amendment to the main bill.
The ships are especially important for the Coast Guard, which oversees 800,000 nautical miles of Alaska's coasts. According to an internal memo released within the Coast Guard, the branch needs 10 icebreakers to do their jobs in the U.S. Arctic waters. Currently, they have just two.
Our Coast Guard does the most with the least that you can imagine. But with every passing year, we see the news, we see the increasing water and decreasing ice in the Arctic, and there's more room for the Coast Guard to operate.
Operations in the Arctic are just one of the Coast Guard's 11 missions, and the heavy breakers comprise a single need in a litany for the aging fleet of vessels. Still, Captain Tony Hahn is the chief of public affairs with the Coast Guard and says that ships with heavy ice capabilities are important to a number of the country's interests.
When you really think about it, icebreakers are really national assets for the U.S. You know, they provide a venue for the National Science Foundation to gain access for critical scientific research. We need assured access for national defense, national interests, and Coast Guard missions. And those missions really surround, you know, making sure we're able to provide for commerce, get into access spaces for search and rescue, and critical supply delivery, those kind of things.
Many different governmental bodies are anticipating a greater need for Arctic capabilities and capacity. Last week, the Defense Department released its Arctic Strategy Plan outlining general needs and interests for a bigger American presence in northern waters. At Monday's City Council meeting in Nome, Representative Neil Foster touted Nome's proposed port expansion as an important step for developing economic interests further into the Arctic. And Felling says Senator Murkowski sees the proposed icebreakers as a necessary step to keep up with global competitors for resources.
We really need to step up our game and give the Coast Guard what they need to protect us, and also give the Department of Defense what they need to allow us to protect our interests. What we see in the Arctic is 33 icebreakers from Russia, 6 icebreakers from China. All the Scandinavian countries are investing in icebreakers. India has even signed a contract to purchase an icebreaker.
Icebreakers are huge and extremely expensive, especially the heavier models sought in the proposed legislation. Each one costs around $900 million and takes between 8 and 10 years to build. Murkowski and Begich's co-sponsors for the amendment are Senators Cantwell and Murray, both of Washington. In Nome, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Congress isn't passing many bills, so it would seem unlikely that it could pass anything as controversial as opening the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to drilling. Still, two campaigns, Arctic Power and the Alaska Wilderness League, remain on the job in Washington, D.C. One has been fighting for 20 years to allow development, the other working just as long to ensure that day never comes. APRN's Liz Ruskin has the story.
These days, Arctic Power operates out of a hotel-like building in the fashionable Penn Quarter area of Washington, known for its proximity to galleries and restaurants. It's actually an apartment building. Campaign chief Adrian Herrera says Arctic Power recently emerged from warm shutdown status. For a few years, it had no real office.
The last Alaska State Legislature grant allowed us to lease this office and have a second employee. And so we have had this operation here for a year.
Herrera's own apartment is in the same building, so his commute is very short. Arctic Power was founded in 1992. Herrera says he understands Alaskans are frustrated Arctic Power's work isn't finished yet. Polls show Alaskans overwhelmingly favor oil drilling there, but that would take another act of Congress, and polls show most Americans hate the idea. So Arctic Power keeps trying, even now with the Senate and the White House in the hands of committed opponents of ANWR development and the nation awash in oil from North Dakota and Texas. Herrera says it's the central conundrum of ANWR. Alaskans believe in responsible oil extraction, while other Americans want this distant place locked up.
It's the difference between the people who live there, who find their living off the land, who eat and work on the land every single day, and a state that gets nearly its entire income from that land use, versus people who have never been there.
But Herrera says circumstances can shift suddenly in Washington, and Arctic Power needs to be ready. When gasoline prices climb, for instance, lawmakers are more inclined to open ANWR.
You don't give up. You can't afford to. I mean, that's our job too. So, yes, I mean, realistically speaking, if it came to the floor under current situations, well, it probably wouldn't even come to the floor. But is the debate still taking place in hearings? Absolutely. Are the public still listening? Absolutely.
Financially, Arctic Power has had fat years and lean years. Oil companies pulled out long ago, so the group's primary funder has been the state of Alaska, which has contributed $12 million over the years, sometimes a million or two a year, sometimes a tenth of that. Still, Herrera calls it a grassroots organization. About a mile away, just off the Capitol grounds, is the headquarters of Alaska Wilderness League, on the second floor of an unremarkable office block. Some 10 people work here, and 10 more in Alaska field offices. While Arctic Power's budget recently doubled to $300,000, Alaska Wilderness League has an annual budget of more than $3 million. It initially focused only on the Arctic Refuge, but has since expanded into other Alaska issues, including logging. Despite its healthy budget, Arctic campaign director Lydia Weiss says they don't lobby in fat cat style.
Well, I do not take members of Congress golfing. I don't buy them steak dinners. We don't, we do not have that sort of budget. That's not how it works. I pick up the phone and I ask for time to meet with staff people and I sit down and I do it the old-fashioned way.
Alaska Wilderness League chooses the more evocative route. They always call it the Arctic Refuge and the Coastal Plain, never ANWR or 1002 area. They use beautiful photographs and deploy interns dressed in polar bear suits. Weiss makes no apologies for the bear costumes. At rallies and protests, everyone from tourists to members of Congress want to pose for photos with the bear. Weiss says the fursuits work as intended by drawing attention and, she says, reminding people what's at stake. Weiss, originally from New York State, also freely admits one of the worst accusations flung at her side. She's never been to this coastal plain she's devoting her career to.
It costs thousands of dollars for somebody to get into the coastal plain of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. If that's the threshold for being able to care about this place, that's a recipe for making sure that only the richest, most elite people in America are allowed to weigh in on it. I'm not one of those people. I never had any expectation of going to the coastal plain of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. But one of the things that makes me proudest as an American is our wilderness ethic.
Senators who champion their effort, Maria Cantwell of Washington and Mark Kirk of Illinois, recently introduced a bill that would declare the coastal plain of ANWR a wilderness area, forever off limits to oil development. It's a recurring favorite for environmentalists, but people on both sides of the issue say the same thing when asked about its chances of becoming law. It would be hard to get anything this controversial through Congress. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
The first day of cross-country ski racing in this season's opening World Cup event has come to a close. Alaska Pacific University's Keegan Randall claimed a silver medal in the women's classic-style sprint race in Kosamo, Finland. Classic sprint has always been a challenge. She told Faster.com she wasn't planning on a podium finish, but a long season of training is starting to pay off.
It feels great. I mean, 7 months is a long time to train, and we don't have that many really clear measures of where we're at. You can kind of have a general feeling that things are going pretty well, but it's very anxious by the time you get to the race season, and so it was cool to put it out there and have everybody here and have a strong performance and just see, you know, that extra boost of confidence that everything's on track.
Randall is looking to claim a medal at the Olympic Games in Sochi, Russia in February. She's the reigning world champion and has competed in 3 Olympic Games. She finished Friday morning's race just behind Poland's Justyna Kowalczyk in the 1.4-kilometer classic sprint race. Randall has never made the podium in a classic ski sprint race before. 2 other American women placed in the top 30. Sadie Bjornsson came in 16th. Ida Sargent finished the race in 26th. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, how to catch a junco.
You let go of the string and then the trap comes down on the bird. And then you just go out and get it. Doesn't hurt them.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley, celebrating 60 years in Alaska. Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. And by Alex Hotel and Suites, featuring 122 guest rooms with amenities that include a 24-hour airport shuttle and Wi-Fi. Information on Alaska resident rates at 1-800-221-7550.
This year's Great Alaska Shootout Basketball Tournament kicked off in Anchorage on Tuesday. Georgetown University women's basketball team took home the women's shootout title, beating the University of Alaska Anchorage 92-78 in the championship game. APRN's Josh Edge reports.
Georgetown's 12-point lead going into halftime proved to be too much for the Seawolves. In the post-game press conference, both coaches had similar ideas on what the deciding factor was. Game planning.
As Mike Tyson said, everyone has a game plan until the first hit.
That's Georgetown head coach Jim Lewis.
And you have to be able to be flexible and adjust on the fly, if you will.
And adjust they did. Georgetown was able to dominate in the paint, nearly doubling the Seawolves in rebounds. For UAA head coach Ryan McCarthy, it was a game that was nearly impossible for his team to plan for.
To play a team like Georgetown that's as athletic as they are, there's no way we can simulate that in practice, or, you know, there's no way you can game plan for a team that is that athletic. I mean, at our level, we don't see teams like that ever.
Coach McCarthy said after Tuesday's game against UC Riverside, where the Seawolves staged a second-half comeback and won in a double overtime thriller, UAA was mentally exhausted.
Your team has a tank of emotion, and once it's empty, you can't refill it. And I think that we used up a lot of that emotion. I mean, a double overtime game where it's just, you know, I think emotionally it just absolutely drains you.
UC Riverside took third place, beating Nichols State 74-64. The men's tournament continues through Saturday. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
A 2-year effort to improve medical care in Delta Junction got a big boost earlier this month in the form of a $400,000 grant that will enable the Interior Alaska Hospital Foundation to open a clinic by March. And now foundation members have launched a drive to raise at least $150,000 for a pharmacy they'd like to open along with the clinic. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
The Delta-based Hospital Foundation has come a long way since it set out in 2011 to provide better health care for the area's 6,000 residents. They commissioned studies, lobbied lawmakers, and cajoled local business persons to donate 13 acres of land and build a 10-bed long-term care center for the elderly. Foundation member Mary Kaspari says the grant gives her organization a much-needed shot in the arm for its next project, opening up a primary care clinic in the ground floor of the long-term care facility.
It's a break. It's a huge break in moving the project forward.
Kaspari is a registered nurse and the driving force behind the campaign. About a year ago, she initiated a partnership with Glen Allen-based Crossroad Medical Center, which will run the new clinic. Joel Medendorp is Crossroad's president and CEO, and he says the faith-based nonprofit is planning to move aggressively to meet the deadline for opening the clinic and soon thereafter begin expanding services.
The very first step is to get primary care services going. And very quickly behind it, we want to follow with lab, x-ray, pharmacy, urgent care.
Delta has never had a pharmacy and the grant won't pay for one, so the Hospital Foundation is launching another drive to raise at least $150,000 to open one. Kaspari says Foundation members will be talking with representatives of big companies that operate in the area, and she says they'd welcome any donations from anyone who may be looking for a good tax break by the end of the year.
Any type of donation coming to us is considered a tax deduction because we are in the nonprofit status with the IRS.
Kaspari knows firsthand about the area's healthcare needs. She worked for more than 10 years at the Family Medical Center, which for years has been Delta's only healthcare facility. But the privately run clinic offers only limited services and has been cutting back over the past year, reportedly due to a lack of business. In March, the clinic began operating only during weekday business hours. Both Medendorp and Kaspari disagree with those who suggest there's not enough businesses for the two clinics in the area, which sprawls roughly from the Canadian border to Paxson and north to Salcha. Medendorp says because Crossroad already has administrative staff, it'll be able to absorb most of the costs of launching the new Delta facility, which will be called the Interior Alaska Medical Clinic. And he says those same economies of scale will benefit both clinics that Crossroad will be operating.
Because we're going to be more sustainable, we're going to be able to do more for the Delta Junction area. And because the Delta Junction area is more sustainable, we'll be able to do more for the Glen Allen area.
In Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
An oil and gas exploration well drilled in the Nenana Basin has not yet yielded a commercially viable deposit. But Doyon Corporation Vice President of Land and Resources Jim Mary says the nearly 9,000-foot well, about 16 miles west of Nenana, has inspired the corporation to keep looking.
Although the well was not a commercial success, what we did see are excellent potential reservoirs, lots of expelled gases, including condensates. And these kinds of things, these wet gases, are certainly indicative of not just gas, but also oil systems. And we're very encouraged by what we see.
Mary stresses that the well is only the second deep drilling that's happened in the Nenana Basin. He says the company is planning additional exploration work.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority is developing the Kinnick Arm Crossing to further develop the transportation system between Anchorage and the Matsu Borough. The bridge could create construction jobs, provide access to land for commercial, industrial, and residential development, and shorten the route to Alaska's interior and North Slope. There's more information on the Kinnick Arm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority. The Older Persons Action Group, publisher of Senior Voice, Alaska's only statewide newspaper for older Alaskans and their families, can be read online at seniorvoicealaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Travis Gilmore. This week on AK, banding birds. Alaska has its share of big science projects, to be sure. But to get results, science doesn't always have to be huge. In Sitka, a project in its second year is studying the seasonal movements of juncos and some other sparrows. It started as a way to involve kids in science and to answer some basic questions about a species so common that we haven't taken the trouble to study it. KCAW's Robert Woolsey spent some time last week with a bird bander and has this story.
I don't think I've ever interviewed anybody at a whisper.
Sorry, I hope it comes out.
I find Gwen Bayless a couple of blocks up the street from where I live. She's sitting just inside a downstairs window in the home of Scott Harris, who works for the Sitka Conservation Society. She's poised by the window, which is slightly ajar, holding a thread. When she releases it, a device known as a hall trap unfurls, ideally right on top of some unsuspecting juncos.
Yeah, it's not looking good out there.
Juncos tend to arrive at backyard feeders in waves, and the latest flock took flight after a cat stopped by. Harris's 7-year-old son Tommy has been kneeling by the window all morning. He understands the hall trap and what it's like to be a few inches away from a creature that most of us only ever see at a distance.
And then when seeing the needle, you let go of this.
Right.
And you let go of the string, and then the trap comes down on the bird. And then you just go out and get it. It doesn't hurt them.
The cat's visit has pretty much ended trapping this morning. This is a setback, but only a small one. Bayless's project has a very limited scope.
I'm not color banding any birds anywhere else in Southeast Alaska, so okay. Sitka's actually getting a lot of color. But as of right now, if you see a color banded bird in Southeast Alaska, chances are that it came from Sitka. If it's a junco or a chickadee or a song sparrow, those are the three species that I have the color bands for.
Bayless is attaching tiny colored bands to the legs of juncos, only in Sitka. Anywhere from 1 to 4 bands per bird, like color coding. Various combinations of white, green, yellow, red, black, and light blue. It's an inspired strategy.
That's the nice thing about the color banding. A bird watcher or anyone that just happened to see a color-tagged bird could report those, and we would know which bird it was with a fair level of confidence.
Bayless is a wildlife technician for the Forest Service in Juneau. Her agency, the Sitka Conservation Society, and the University of Alaska co-sponsor her research. After lunch, it's time to change venues. We're in the potting shed of the community garden behind Blatchley Middle School. The noise that sounds like hail is actually from the marble-sized raindrops Southeast is famous for. As I arrive, Bayless and Harris have just bagged a bird, literally. They've released the trap, and Bayless reaches in, grabs the junco, and stuffs it into a little cloth sack. After she attaches the bands, she measures the length of its primary feathers and checks its fat content. Earlier, she told me you can see right through the skin of small birds. She holds up this junco and starts to gently blow apart the downy feathers on its breast.
And that kind of yellowish stuff you see through there is fat. Well, actually, some of it is corn that he just ate, but down below is fat. There's some stuff in his crop that I see.
I've been interested in birds ever since, really, I moved to Sitka, but I never knew that they were see-through like this, that you could actually see their last meal.
Yeah,
heading down the pipe.
You can see the crop.
Bayless has banded 44 juncos in 2 days, despite the weather. One ruby-crowned kinglet, one white-crowned sparrow, one fox sparrow, and one song sparrow. Last year, she did almost 100 birds. And these few birds have already taught us something important. Except for a few slate-colored juncos that move in each winter from Canada, our local juncos were always thought to be year-round residents. 144 banded birds say otherwise.
Last year, of all the birds that we color banded, none were seen in the summertime at all. So they moved somewhere, not just, perhaps just out of town to a, you know, wooded area where people weren't hiking, but possibly quite a bit farther than that.
So does this mean an entire population of songbirds moves out of Sitka in winter, only to be replaced by an identical population moving in? That's a pretty big conclusion, even for small science. For AK in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Now it's time for 300 Villages. This week, we're heading 80 miles southwest of Bethel to a village the locals call Quigg.
My name is Andrew Beaver. I'm the tribal administrator for our governing body, Native Village of Kuilong. I'm only 70. I don't feel that old and have 13 grandchildren. Personally, I enjoyed going out, doing some business, fun. It's part of our, it's like a recreation. Like, we enjoy the nature environment. We're pretty much done with our summer subsistence fishing. We've tried salmon and freeze some of them. And right now we're in the process of trying smaller fish tomcods. We don't have any restaurants or hotels. We have places where people can sleep, like families open their doors and bring in strangers in. But school also opens their doors to have somebody stay there with minimum cost. But we have general stores to provide mostly canned food, some limited frozen or refrigerated. It's not like in city. I think our community is keeping their language, Yupik language. That's our first language, and 99% of the population speak our language fluently.
Andrew Beaver is the tribal administrator in Quigg. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. If you want your community featured, send us an email at news@alaskapublic.org. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Robert Woolsey, Monica Goki, Annie Fite, and Dave Waldron. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Travis Gilmore.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Zachariah Hughes in Nome, Emily Schwing and Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Tim Ellis in Delta. APRN's Josh Edge reported from Anchorage and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Pat Yak is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank of Alaska, offering business solutions to help Alaska's dreams grow for more than 90 years. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC.
And by
ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Alaska's Tobacco Quitline is ready to help you succeed in your decision to quit tobacco. Take advantage of proven, successful, free resources. Trained quit coaches will provide support services to help you quit for good with confidential counseling. There's free nicotine replacement therapy and a tailored quit plan just for you. For more information, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance. Many Alaska business owners are paying too much for energy. The Commercial Building Energy Audit Program identifies an average of 30% in energy savings. The application period runs November 1st through December 20th. To learn more, visit akenergyefficiency.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Energy Authority.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.